This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Great Dismal Swamp stretches for tens of thousands of acres across the North Carolina-Virginia border in the northeast corner of our state. Its shadowy interior remains a haven for bears, snakes, and in the hazy days of summer, millions of swarming bugs as well. During the 18th century, the swamp provided refuge for humans as well. Thousands of enslaved people escaped bondage to live deep in the swamps, forming maroon communities that were protected from capture by the swamp's formidable natural barriers. Maroon communities, of course, were not unique to the Great Dismal Swamp. They formed in just about any place where enslaved people sought freedom. Joining me in the studio today is Michelle Lanier. Her work focuses on the complex history of what we know as the Underground Railroad. She's acting director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission. On the phone from the cooler climes of Michigan is Dan Sayers. He's an assistant professor of anthropology at American University. His research concentrates on the anthropological history of the Great Dismal Swamp. Michelle and Dan, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks indeed, Frank.
Dan, you've just completed another round of archaeological exploration at the Great Dismal Swamp. How long have you been studying the communities that live there?
Well, I began what I call the Great Dismal Swamp Landscape Study. The really early steps were the fall of 2001. But I began field work in the Great Dismal Swamp National Wildlife Refuge in the fall of 2003, about 2 weeks or so after Hurricane Isabel ravaged the region, if that's in recent memory for most.
It is. What is it about these communities that interest you?
Well, the inspiration, frankly. The idea that so many, potentially thousands of people, sort of took charge, right, of their lives under sort of enslavement conditions. And they looked around the sort of landscape in this region, and they saw this vast, at the time, 1,500 to 2,000 square mile swamp. And they realized that, well, we can go in there, and we can take control of our labors, our lives, our daily lives, and even the kinds of communities that we form. So a lot of different people people with different backgrounds going in the swamp with relatively similar intentions, that is, just sort of freeing themselves of the yoke of oppression and the tyrannies of slavery.
And Michelle, paint the picture for us. When did enslaved people begin to find this place as a haven, and what do we know about them and the communities they formed?
Well, that's a really interesting question. When we look at runaway history in North Carolina in general, what we can see is that there's evidence of running away from the first moment of enslavement. And all along, freedom seekers were using swamps, forests, rivers. So really, you can take us back to the early 1700s, the late 1600s, and see resistance to slavery, particularly concerns around shiploads of whether they were coming from the West Indies, which was more common in North Carolina, or much rarer coming from the coast of West Africa. But certainly swamps, rivers, forests come up quite a bit in the narratives as well as the runaway ads that we have to tell us the story of freedom seeking in the state.
Now, as a historian, what kind of record do you have and what do you use to find out about the people who live there?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. Often people assume that there's not a lot of recorded information about runaway history, and in fact, that's not true. A seminal text that I use time and time again is Stealing a Little Freedom by Freddie Parker, who's a professor of history at North Carolina Central University. And what he has done is to transcribe ads, runaway slave ads, from across the state of North Carolina from the 1700s into the 1800s. And there are literally thousands of ads which give us the names and some personality and help to debunk some myths about slaves not owning property, not being literate. Names like Juba and Sparrow and Matt and Piety show up in these ads. We also see evidence in narratives such as Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, also the narrative by Moses Grandy. Whereas Harriet Jacobs did not run away to the Dismal Swamp, she did run to what is called Snaky Swamp outside of Edenton.
Well, Dan Sayers, as difficult as it might be to find the historical record, I would think the archaeological record in a place like a swamp would be even more as challenging, if not more so. Tell us how you know anything about what happens in a swamp hundreds of years after it happened.
I'll just follow up with what Michelle said. Certainly there's a lot of documentation of the sort of presence of Maroons in the Great Dismal, but as an anthropologist, what really kind of gets us fired up is sort of determining what social systems, kinship systems, cultural landscapes, belief systems, religions, anything of that sort, what sorts of systems of those kinds did these communities sort of subscribe to and develop on their own once they're in the swamp. And in that regard, the documentation is much more scanty. So archaeology in this case, as in other contexts, is extremely important for sort of fleshing out some of that history. And so going into the swamp in 2003, I was sort of armed with research I had done the previous year and a half, but a lot of that resulted in these sort of predictive models, I call them. And that basically was just sort of based on a lot of different research of other historians, other archaeologists, but mostly the primary or the original sources, documents relating to the swamp, and sort of trying to take an educated sort of not guess, but let's just say that for the sake of argument, an educated guess at what we might expect out in that swamp if, in fact, we were going to find evidence of Maroon communities. And so I had this sort of essentially complex hypothesis in mind, and so we had to actually just go around surveying in this almost 200-square-mile National Wildlife Refuge because, in fact, no archaeology had really been done in that refuge before. So we had some clues, but basically we had to start from scratch, and so we did ultimately find some of these sites, but that was through a lot of just sort of difficult survey and so on. But what it involves, once we found these areas of slightly drier ground, is really what it amounts to compared to the rest of the swamp, was then we had to do what archaeologists do, right, which is excavate. And there are a variety of methods for that, but eventually, sort of to the scale that we're doing now with the American University field schools, we just had to expose a lot of soil below the ground. And what we're finding is essentially what we sort of predicted, which is a lot of evidence of these communities transforming the swamp landscape for daily living, but not using a lot of materials or stuff, right, from the world outside the swamp. So the standard stuff you might find at, say, a plantation site, white clay tobacco pipe fragments, the mass-produced sort of ceramic bowls and vessels that were in cupboards, spoons, you name it, right? Trinkets of everyday life. Mm. We just don't find a lot of that out there, and that was predicted. Rather, what we're seeing is this sort of ethos and community structure based on relatively extreme self-reliance. And that means translates into these communities using what was available in the swamp. Not particularly surprising, but what was available was, and this is one of those interesting things, I think, a lot of materials left behind by indigenous Americans in the previous centuries and millennia. So you have people in the 1700s, late 1600s, going out into the swamp and finding old stone tools, for example, and then, to the best of their ability, recrafting them into tools they could use at that point in time. And so this happened repeatedly over and over again, and this is the kind of stuff we're finding in the ground.
Michelle, what was the advantage of living in the swamp for those communities?
Well, I'd like to use a quote from Olmsted's A Journey in the Seaboard Slave States with remarks on their economy. He said, "The dismal swamps are noted places of refuge for runaway Negroes. Children were born, bred, lived, and died here. There were people in the swamps still," he thought, "that were the children of runaways and who had been runaways themselves all their lives." And he said, "What a life it must be, born outlaws, educated self-stealers, trained from infancy to be constantly in the dread of the approach of a white man as a thing more fearful than wildcats or serpents or even starvation." And so what we see in this quote is Olmsted describes a group of people, a community of people that were often called Maroons, which comes from the Spanish word cimarrones, which means wild ones, that had adapted more to a wild landscape, which in some ways he's arguing is safer than the alternative of being held in bondage.
And it was particularly forbidding in this period, late 1600s, early 1700s, when it was a kind of a wild swamp before it was developed at all.
Right. And it was also used as a place for commerce. I mean, we know about George Washington's connection to the swamp as a place of commerce. We know that monies that were attained from the Dismal Swamp were used to fund education in North Carolina. We know that in the case of Moses Grandy, who has a narrative that that can be read online, actually, that he used his work making shingles in the Dismal Swamp to purchase his freedom, sometimes even hiring as an enslaved man. He even hired teams himself of these maroons.
Well, this is interesting, and maybe we should talk about this, because slaves would get actual cash bonuses if they worked over and above a quota, and they could use that money to buy freedom.
Right, at times. This is helpful in understanding how complex and complicated the institution of slavery was, and some would say still is. When you look at Harriet Jacobs' experience in the Snaky Swamp, she talks about passing the night there, of constant terror of snakes, of burning fever, and that how when she finally had a chance to leave the swamp, only after 2 days of living there and to hide out, that she was greatly relieved. So some runaways were actually using the swamps as just a temporary hiding place, as a network to freedom rather than an enclave or an oasis of freedom within a slave state.
Dan, are you able to tell as an archaeologist how things changed as the swamp became developed? We know canals went in there, logging was practiced in the area. How did that change life for the communities that lived there?
Well, in fact, it turns out that general a set of questions revolving around that very central question is what's driving our more recent American University field schools. What I'd noticed in the three seasons I excavated out in the swamp for my dissertation work was that most of what I found, if not all of what I found, didn't actually date up until even like 1800. It was the late 1700s were the latest dates I was obtaining from a variety of means. And that got me to thinking, of course, what was going on at this area of this particular site that we're focusing on, what was going on at 1800 that would cause people to dramatically change their sort of use of that area of the site. In other words, a non-presence really that we could detect after around 1800. So it's around that time that canal and lumbering sort of the sort of system, or the rise of the canal company systems, really hit the swamp. Before that, there was very little intrusion of the outside world into the interior and all throughout the swamp. After around 1800, the majority of these sort of pre-Civil War canals are excavated by enslaved laborers. And then after the canals are excavated, these sort of communities, settlements of company-paid workers, enslaved company workers, but they're paid, as Michelle said, eventually at some point, at least a lot of them are, they form in the swamp, and those are typically along these canals. And what I ended up expecting to happen was basically after 1800, at these more interior sites, which is what we're focusing on, these communities of maroons were certainly impacted by the intrusion of the outside world in the swamp, but in fairly specific ways. And one of them was, I think, after around 1800, people who were marooning into the swamp and making their decisions on how they were going to go about it, they found that these new settlements of enslaved company workers offered a different kind of opportunity than living in one of the more self-reliant interior communities. And so a lot of maroons after 1800 or so were being sort of deciding to go work in these sort of underground sort of labor arrangements that Michelle just described. And that sort of helped sort of create change in these communities in the interior, if this makes sense. And so these interior communities basically, so goes my thinking at the moment, they shrunk in terms of how many people were part of the community after 1800. And so right now what we're doing is we're focusing in at a different area of the same site that I've worked on before, and this is the highest elevation point of the island, or of the site. And what it amounts to is the idea is that as the community shrunk in size, what we might see is an increase, or a presence, I should say, after 1800 at the highest point, because by default people are moving towards that high point. Mm. And so essentially our research right now, it's still preliminary for the last 3 years, but we're seeing definitely an increase of outside world materials. Now, these aren't big pieces or anything. There's nothing highly dramatic here in terms of usual historical archaeology, but for our site, it's quite a dramatic change. And so we're now starting to see little chips of glass. We're starting to see the white clay tobacco pipe fragments, starting to see a decent quantity of small bits and pieces of iron. We even found a few brick fragments at the site this year, which was quite surprising. So a brick managed to get several miles into the interior of the swamp. So basically, yeah, the rise of the canal era, I think, really had a dramatic impact, not only because of the outside world sort of hustling and bustling throughout the canals and these new communities of enslaved workers, but they had these sort of dendritic or, you know, sort of web-like effects on these interior communities, and it changed that sort of social and economic world that had developed for several centuries in that swamp.
And so instead of being, Michelle, just a kind of hideout where if you got there, the chances of you being followed in were much smaller, very late 1600s, early 1700s. Now there's the mixing that Dan describes, even people coming to work to pick up a few dollars. But also it changes because now this is part of that thing we call the Underground Railroad. Maybe you should sort that out for us too and you know, sort of describe for us what it was and what it wasn't.
Right.
And how the swamp was a part of it.
Right, absolutely. We're at a time right now where the Underground Railroad is becoming more and more apparent in terms of its importance to North Carolina's history. We can see that geography and the social makeup of our state created a place where not only do we have people from within North Carolina who were seeking freedom in great numbers across the state. We also had people from throughout the South who were using North Carolina as a route to freedom. We can look at the river systems, many of our rivers, the Tar, the Roanoke, the Neuse, the Pamlico, they all have direct documented connections to freedom seekers. We also have the Quaker tradition of our state in communities like New Garden and Greensboro and Rich Square near Halifax. People like Levi Coffin, who was born in North Carolina and then was told he had to leave the state because he and his brother created a school for African Americans in Guilford County. And he was 30-something years old before he left North Carolina. So a great deal of his work in supporting freedom seekers and in abolition was done here in North Carolina before he moved to Indiana. We also have, because of the large free black population that's been well documented by John Hope Franklin, this created a perfect storm, so to speak, for people to either seek safe havens or to pass as free. And what that means is if you were in a community like Colonial Halifax as a freedom seeker and you had a skill and you happened to be literate, which actually quite a number of slaves were literate, you could pass as free. You could forge a free pass or forge manumission papers and pass as free.
Halifax and Wilmington, too, had
Wilmington, thriving. Yes, Wilmington, particularly the story of William Gould, who sought his freedom on the Maritime Underground Railroad at the with the outbreak of the Civil War. Speaking of the Civil War and its connection to the Dismal Swamp and freedom seekers or the experience of freedom in North Carolina, in 1863, with the passing of the Emancipation Proclamation and, of course, with the occupation of the Union forces in that part of our state, there was a moment where Wilde's African Brigade was infused by men who were in hiding in the Dismal Swamp. And so you can imagine this very dramatic moment of a military, you know, envoy going into the swamp and coming out liberating people who had been still the vestiges of the Maroon colonies, and some of those Maroons actually joining forces with the United States Colored Troops.
I want to thank you both for sharing the great history of the Dismal Swamp. Michelle Lanier, Acting Director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission and Curator of Multicultural Initiatives for the North Carolina Division of State Historic Sites and Properties, and Dan Sayers, an Assistant Professor of Anthropology at American University. Thank you both for being on the program.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Next up on The State of Things, looking at safety on the highways in the wake of several fatal truck and bus accidents. Stay with us on The State of Things.